Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 9th, 1999, and in the fireside room this afternoon, Bob Ekblad is doing a session, and today's session number is number 5, EKB 99-5, and it's titled Journey to El Norte: Pull Factors Drawing Immigrants Here. So now let's tune in on Bob for this session.
This session is going to be on the kind of struggles that immigrants face as they come into this country. And actually, I want to talk about the whole journey from, you know, Mexico or Central America up to the north. And I got a number of slides, but not as many as for the other sessions. So anyway, we left off yesterday talking about push factors, and I mean, push factors was the first day. Yesterday was addressing push factors at their roots through sustainable development and sort of grassroots community organizing. And but you know, there are very few successful programs in Mexico and Central America that are succeeding in keeping people in their communities, you know, on the land. Many people just aren't able to make it at all, and so they make plans to, you know, to head north. And there are lots of ways to get north, and kind of the further south you are, the more expensive it is and the more difficult it is. But one of the major ways is there's in pretty much every town, or, you know, major town in Central America and Mexico, there are representatives of different smuggling groups. You know, people that have friends that are smugglers, that they'll get some kind of a commission for every person that they can recruit. And people, like, I know from the border of Mexico, like Tijuana, Ciudad Juarez, it costs $1,300 per adult, you know, just to get to Los Angeles or to Phoenix, whichever city you're trying to get to. And, you know, it may take 5 tries to get there, but the coyotes, or the polleros, they call them. Coyotes are like coyotes, or polleros. They will guarantee, you know, that they'll keep trying to bring you across as often as it takes until finally you're there. And unfortunately, many people don't have the money at all to pay that kind of money. And so there are also international drug smugglers who recruit people and give them drugs to carry across, you know, with promises that they can pay off their, you know, whatever the fee is, by selling drugs for a while in L.A. And they'll have an immediate sort of setup in one of the major cities to sell drugs once they've sort of carried some across. So that's sort of the poor man's, you know, way to get into the United States. And these are all people that would never qualify for any kind of a tourist visa or any kind of a... an immigrant visa. You know, by far the majority of Central American Mexican people can't qualify just because of their economics. And we had this experience recently where we tried to bring up our 3 Honduran workers from Tierra Nueva, and we had all kinds of support. I mean, I sent the consulate photocopies of their tickets, you know, and letters from our ministry saying that we were going to support them 100%, and telling them we had insurance for them, and they weren't going to work, and we had the support of all these churches, and the Presbyterian, North Puget Sound, the Lutheran Church, and all these things, and they were denied a visa because they didn't have a job, you know, because they were peasants, right? They weren't employed by anybody, and they didn't have a bank account. And, you know, normally you have to have a well-established bank account that shows quite a bit of money, and you have to have titles for properties and things like that. So the majority of that excludes the majority by far. So the only way to come up is illegally. So anyway, it's quite a dangerous trip. You know, the further south you are, the more dangerous it is, and the more expensive it is. You know, from Honduras, I don't know exactly how expensive it is. It's probably at least 2 times as expensive. You know, maybe $2,500 or something, or $3,000. You know, to be accompanied north. But, you know, there's many stories of, especially of women who are raped and who are, you know, abused and all kinds of things along the way by people that take advantage of them. I want to read two stories of that we published. These are stories of that we interview people in our area about how did you get here? You know, this is part of our newspaper that's called Short Stories of Immigrant Journeys. Okay, so this is a clue of what it's like to come across. I still have nightmares about this happening 8 years ago. My husband did not want to be separated from us anymore. It was very difficult for him and for us. He'd been here in the USA 8 months and only 4 months with us. My children were growing up and they needed him. And so we came, my three children, ages 2, 7, and 10, and my husband's niece and I. We were in Tijuana for 1 week. We tried 4 times. Every night we had to walk about 3 hours. I carried my youngest child throughout this whole time. Night after night, the Border Patrol caught us. They took us to the detention center. They left us for the rest of the night, and they took us out early in the early morning. We endured hunger and cold in that place. My youngest boy then would recognize them because of the intensely bright lights of their cars. When he would see the lights, he'd scream and cry because it scared him so much. On the second night, the Border Patrol caught us again. My husband's niece and my children ran away. I screamed and ran away also to stop them, because I knew it was worse if we ran. One of the Border Patrol agents grabbed the arm of my husband's niece so hard that he left a bruise on it. Then they pushed us into a ditch filled with sewer water. On one of these nights, we heard a teenage girl screaming desperately for help. Our guide told us that gang members were accustomed to raping women. Because of that, we took a different route and the Border Patrol caught us again. Also, there was a time when the Border Patrol caught up with us. We all hid, but there were a lot of people. I was carrying my youngest boy, but I didn't see the others, and I didn't know if the Border Patrol had taken them or if they were hiding. I was anguishing a lot, thinking that I could lose my children or that something could be happening to them. I left from where I was hiding in such a way that the Border Patrol stopped me. As it happened, I then started yelling to the others, and little by little, they came out of their hiding places. Upon seeing everyone together, I breathed a sigh of relief. One of the times that the Border Patrol caught us, on the way, we ran into a teenage girl who was crying with great anguish and was lost. The Border Patrol stopped and asked her what was wrong, and she explained to them that she'd lost her family along the way, and crying. She pleaded with them to take her with them. The Border Patrol amused themselves by shining their lights up and down on her. She begged them to give her a ride, but they answered that they didn't give rides, and they left her crying hysterically in the middle of the darkness. God only knows whatever happened to that girl. Then I told my husband that I was not going anywhere, that I was going to go back because I had not killed anybody. I had not robbed anyone so as to merit this kind of treatment. No, he said, we are going now. The fourth time was the last attempt, and we succeeded. My husband tells me to forget about it. I say yes, but every other night I wake up dreaming about what I lived through 8 years ago. I'll read one more. And everybody has their story. They're fascinating stories, some of these. I've been coming and going for 10 or 11 years now, but I had my family in Mexico. I decided to bring them up, my wife and my 5 children. We traveled from Oaxaca by bus, 2 days and 2 nights to get to Tijuana. In Tijuana, I spoke with a friend in Madera who came to help us find a coyote, since he himself didn't know. He spoke with a coyote and personally put us in his charge. There were 15 of us from the same village, and there were another 15 from areas close to ours. He told us to get food and water ready for ourselves because we were going to walk a lot. We left from a place that they call the Hill of Eagles in Tijuana at about 1 in the afternoon. We walked all day, then all night. We stopped to rest or to eat, but we continued our journey. At about 12 noon, we stopped and slept until 7 o'clock at night in order to quickly resume our journey. I carried my 6-year-old boy. My wife carried the 1-year-old. My cousin helped us carry the 2.5-year-old girl. Our other children walked behind us. There were places in which we had to run because cars passed close by. With us came another whole family with three children who also had to be carried. But there were a lot of single men who helped us out. We walked all that night and we stopped to rest only for an hour and a half. I had bought only 2 gallons of water and they ran out quickly, but we filled the empty jugs with stream water. That night our food ran out and we were suffering from not eating and not drinking water because further along the way we no longer found water. Right before arriving in Santiaguito, we found a cucumber field. We walked along and picked cucumbers. Further down the way was the bridge where the coyote told us to get ready. Another companion and I, who had papers, went to make a phone call so that they could pick us up. Immigration didn't get us a single time. When we got to Madera, we were working in order to pay my friend. Well, we owed him $1,500 since he paid. Afterwards, we went to Oregon. We continued to work to finish paying our debt. 3 months after having arrived, we came to Washington, but by then we had finished paying off all the bill. So that's that's about the calmest kind of story I've ever heard. Usually it's more desperate, like the first one. Anyway, I guess we can turn off the lights. Every year there are just thousands and thousands of immigrants who come into the United States illegally. And many of them come into California and into Texas, but those areas, it's much harder to find work now because there's already a large immigrant population. So a lot of people head up into Oregon, I'm not as familiar with the Midwest and the East Coast, but I know there's immigrants everywhere, in many different agricultural communities throughout the United States. But in Oregon, there are many, many, many farm workers that have settled and up into Washington as well. Washington has several hundred thousand migrant farm workers. This is the Skagit Valley where we live. People are drawn into this valley and have been for many years because of all of the seasonal farm work. And the work is the main pull that draws people into this county. You know, immigration experts talk about push factors and pull factors, and we've talked about the push factors, you know, being hunger and war and lack of production of basic grains and, you know, things like hurricanes and, you know, lack of education. And pull factors, the number one pull factor, according to immigration experts, is looking for jobs. Second pull factor is reunification with family. You know, many, many immigrants have settled up here, and their families are divided. You know, they have brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers that are still in Central America or Mexico, and so there's a strong pull, for these people to come and join their family members who are usually surviving and sending some money back to Mexico or Central America. So anyway, in our county, people come for those two reasons, jobs and family reunification, as well as others. The county has, many, many jobs in agriculture. These are migrant farm workers, mainly from Oaxaca, who are planting strawberries. Actually, our first crop is cut flowers, in March or April, more like April. There's all kinds of flowers that come up, the Tulip Festival in the Skagit Valley, and all the people that do all the cultivating of those flowers and cutting are migrant farm workers. Probably half of the migrant farm workers are illegal, are here illegally. And then the strawberry harvest comes on, and this year it'll be about next week. So we planned our family vacation to coincide with, coming back right when all the migrants are coming in. And right now I know they're moving into, there's 9 migrant farm labor camps that house about anywhere from 200 to 500 people. Officially they house that many, and in reality there's usually a lot more than that. And these are like barracks, like military barracks that, that are very marginal kind of living quarters. Basically plywood walls and tin roofs and no heating. And people will begin with the strawberry harvest in mid-June, and then that's followed up immediately by raspberries, and then blueberries, and then cucumbers. And the cucumbers go about to the end of August to mid-September. Then you have potatoes, the sorting of potatoes, and carrots and different things like that. And And then there's a number of fish processing plants, a lot of fish that are brought from Alaska or just that are out, caught out in Puget Sound salmon are processed in our area. And there's meatpacking plants, and those are almost completely, almost all the workers, probably 95% of the workers are Hispanic, and probably half of those are undocumented. So anyway, our objective was to reach out to these folks and start a ministry with them, but we found that it was very difficult because most of the migrant farm workers were working 7 hours a day, 12 hours a day, 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. So when they were free, they'd hang out in the migrant camps and drink Budweiser and, barbecue food and fall asleep. They weren't interested in going to a Bible study. And they weren't, and they saw us with a lot of suspicion because we weren't, we're not Hispanic, although we have a number of Hispanic workers that work with us now. But so the way that we got to know people was to actually go out in the fields and work with them. So there I am with my kids when they were a little younger, two of them. And we would just go out and plant with people, and I'd get permission from the growers, and we'd go out and work beside people and talk to them and get to know them that way. And as we got to know them, we heard all their stories, and each one of their stories are just completely different and unique, and just like these two stories are unique. These people are, many of them are people that follow the crops from place to place. They go from California, or after they do this, they will, after they do the seasonal work in Skagit County, about October, they will go down, after the pumpkin harvest, that's like the last harvest, they'll go down back to Mexico, or back to California or Texas, and then they will winter in those areas, and then, or also go down to, the grape harvest, in California. And there's all kinds of circuits out there, for migrant farm workers. But I know many of them from our area have just come from California, like maybe 2 months ago, up to Eastern Washington, where they're doing the asparagus harvest. Then they go from the asparagus harvest to the, across over to the strawberry harvest where we are. So these are families that are on the road and have been for their, for their whole history. Many of these older folk people are children of farm workers. So this is, this is several generations. And oftentimes out in these fields, you'll have three or four generations of people working side by side. This is a guy who spends most of his time down in California, but comes up for 3 months every year he comes up mainly for the cucumber harvest and makes a little bit of cash. And the way they make money is by bringing as many family members as they possibly can. And they work as a team, and they pull all their money together, and a whole family out. But because of child labor laws, kids who are under 13 can't work. And, that's caused a lot of problems for migrant farm workers. It's made it much harder for them to make a living, to make it. It's not as easy to make it. And in many ways, I see it as a negative thing. Because farm worker children are never going to learn this kind of work, and so they don't have a place in the culture anymore, in their own culture. And many of them experience tremendous alienation, By the time they're a teenager, there's no way they're going to want to go out and start farm work, right? If they've grown up sort of doing it, and they have those skills and they're used to it, then they're likely to continue. But because of the child labor laws, we're basically, these young people, what happens is they get left, and they raise themselves, and many of them join gangs, and there are a lot of the guys who I deal with in the jail, because they're just underparented. Both adult parents are out in the fields, and that's the only way they can make a living, because the wages are so low doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. What are the wages?
The wages are, minimum wage is about $5, $5.20 an hour in our state, I think, and if they're they can make more than that if they, because they're paid according to per bucket. And so they can make, $75 a person a day if they're picking really hard and really fast and there's good cucumbers. But if the cucumbers are, if there's not a good harvest or a lot of it's been damaged because of, bad weather or something, then they can't make nearly as much money. And the growers are required by law to pay them at least minimum wage. But to pay them, more if they make, according to the, piece worker, according to how much they harvest. But many growers don't respect those laws, and so I know people that end up making about $1.50, $2 an hour, There's a lot of exploitation of these people. Another thing that they always have to worry about is this is a pumpkin painting operation. There's hundreds of people that work for this one grower painting pumpkins. One of the great difficulties that farm workers experience is at any time they could experience a raid by the INS. And in our area, we've had many years of where the INS has just come in this particular plant, twice they've come in with helicopters and, you know, big dogs, like 25 agents, and they will surround the whole place and they'll come in, you know, and they'll have a helicopter hovering over, checking anyone who's running, and they'll be radioing to other Border Patrol agents and jeeps who will go roaring after them out and they're chasing them in the fields, and they will just corral all these people together. And, you know, they assume that everybody's undocumented until proven innocent, you know. And there's people that are U.S. citizens, there's people that are permanent residents, and there's undocumented people all mixed together. But everybody has to show their ID, and then they're let go, or else they're detained. And we've had many situations where the Border Patrol has taken women, and their kids are in school. Okay, and so the women are taken and detained, and the next day they're sent down to Seattle, and they're put in, you know, INS detention, a detention facility by the Kingdome down there. And then the next day they're on a plane, or if they're women, they're on a plane, if they're men, they're on a bus down to Mexico. And meanwhile, there's these kids that, and the schools will call us and say, hey, I've got these three kids, do you have any idea where we can put them? You know, because they know that we're the kind of the most visible ministry there.
Mm-hmm. Does the INS wait until the end of the harvest to do this?
They've done that in the past, and it's hard to know whether that's planned or not. You know, we've argued with the INS a lot about that, and they say, oh, it's not at all planned that way, it just so happens that it was like that. But they've hit the farmers at times when they just wiped out whole farming operations. So I don't think it's, you know, I think there's evidence in favor of the Border Patrols when they say that they're not, you know, they're not doing that. But I know in many places down in California, there are lots of people that will call the INS, a lot of employers that will call the INS like 2 days before payday, you know, and like big factories, and have all the people deported. So anyway, this, any time these people could be picked up, and, you know, and families are divided. And, you know, sometimes it's the choice of the mother, too. The mother could say, hey, I've got my whole family. I've got six kids and my husband, and we're all here, you know. But usually the woman won't say that she has any kids, you know, because her plan is to turn around and come back as quick as possible. So, you know, what happens is the whole family just kind of grinds to a halt because, say, the woman's deported, then the man will have to drive all the way down to the Mexican border, come up with $1,300, you know, find someone to take care of his kids or watch his kids himself, you know, and go all the way down. Because they never accept deportation as, you know, as just, they never accept that. The next, they're back in a week, you know, every single time. And I see this every week. You know, every week I'm seeing people deported and, you know, out of the jails or picked up on the streets. And, you know, within 3 days to a week, they're back. You know, but it hurts them. I mean, because when you make a minimum wage, I mean, it takes a long time to make $1,300. And that's just for the coyote. You know, you got to pay for other things like transportation from Southern California up to Washington. You know, the time lost working, you know, and these people are barely making it as it is. Another place where I've met many of the migrants and other Hispanic folks, permanent residents, and, you know, long-time, you know, second-generation immigrants is in the jail. And this is a place where many, many, many people have spent time, you know, many immigrant people. And that's partly due to the fact that of racial targeting. You know, there's been many major news stories about the phenomenon of racial targeting. And it's pretty much acknowledged that, you know, that races, different ethnic groups who might have a high percentage of people who are, you know, who have warrants or whatever, have criminal behavior, are sort of targeted. And that this clearly happens in our county. You know, there's kind of if you're Mexican and you're driving around, you know, kind of a migrant mobile, an old, you know, 72 Chev or something, or an Impala or whatever, you know, some beater car, you know, you're going to get stopped even if you have everything right with your car. The police will find one little tiny crack in a windshield and that'll be their excuse. And what they've been doing in our area is they pull people over and then they will call the Border Patrol if they suspect the person's undocumented. They'll say, are you looking for, you know, Emilio Gonzalez or something? and here's his, we suspect that he's undocumented. What should we do with him? And the Border Patrol and the police will say, we could take him in because he doesn't have a driver's license. You know, I mean, any excuse they can find to take him in, they'll do it. And the Border Patrol has a deal with the jail where every morning the Border Patrol agents show up, they check the records, they interview people that are suspected as undocumented, and the people are out of there. You know, and but many people do also get caught, committing crimes, and every variety, from drug dealing to to just any kind of serious crime, assault or rape or so people go through the whole process here in the jail and are sentenced and many go off to prison. We have a huge percentage of Hispanic, the inmate population in Washington State are Hispanic. And part of the reason they end up in prison too is because most of them cannot afford private attorneys, and they get public defenders who are maxed out, who have huge caseloads, and who can't really represent them adequately. And really they couldn't. They couldn't. I mean, it costs so much money to do the kind of work it takes to win a case. But in addition to that, you have juries that are, like in our county, it's the juries that I've seen are always all white juries. There's never any Hispanics on the jury. And so I've seen people be convicted of crimes that I know that if I committed, I would be out. I see it all the time. So a lot of people end up, a lot of family members come to us. I do two Bible studies in the jail every week, and there I meet everybody who's in there. Almost all the Hispanic folks in the jail come, anywhere from 10 to, five to 25 to 30. And people will tell me their stories and tell me their, I do one-on-one pastoral counseling with them, and many of them put me in contact with their families. This woman's husband was convicted of first-degree rape and just went off to 15 years in prison. And, she was pregnant and had no driver's license, she had a job, but she, anyways, a lot of families are just really broken up by that as well. And so that's kind of where our pastoral ministry comes in, is supporting these families. Most of the immigrant community, or I shouldn't say most, a large percentage of the farm workers do not have driver's licenses, do not have insurance. They drive around, and they're afraid to go get a driver's license because the Border Patrol hangs out at the Department of Licensing. And a lot of times they'll get picked up. They'll get stopped and they'll be told to go to court, but they don't know how to go to court. They're afraid to go to court because the Border Patrol shows up at the courts. So they get warrants out for their arrest. And many of them don't have addresses, so they never get notices for their court appearances. And so there's warrants that get out for their arrest, and then they end up getting stopped another time, and then they get in jail. And so that's why I say it's a common thing for, if you went out and you surveyed, if you visited 25 cabins in a migrant camp and you asked how many people has experienced time in jail, out of 25 cabins, you'd probably find maybe a couple of individuals in every cabin that have been to jail. So the jail is really, and our chaplaincy work there is really a prime place. And I didn't know this when I got asked to be chaplain. It just turned out that it was the perfect place for us to sort of get to know the scene and have our ministry. And a lot of what Gracie does is visits families. There's a whole other community of children of immigrants, and these are grown children of immigrants. They're not fairly grown, and they have a family. Many of these people are people that they grow up in California, and because of the child labor laws, they weren't allowed to work. And they grew up in marginal neighborhoods, and this guy was the head of the East Side Stockton, California gang, and has spent already probably 6 years of his life in prison. And he grew up with syringes right out, all over outside and along the walkways in front of the apartment house where he grew up. And he grew up with both of his parents absent because they were working in the fields. And so he grew up on the streets, basically, and became addicted to cocaine and then heroin as well. And like many addicts, began to sell drugs to supply his habit. So you have this whole other element of second-generation immigrants. They're some of the most beaten-up sort of people that I know. They're wonderful people. And this guy in the jail, he experienced, a real conversion of sorts. And when he got out of jail, he invited me to come and lead Bible studies with him in his house. And I found myself, this is the first Bible study I've done in a crack house. You know, because the only way he could support his family when he got out was selling drugs. I mean, that's the only skill he had. And he kept telling me, "I'm sorry, you know, I'm probably really sinning, aren't I, Roberto?" You know? I said, "Well, you know, that's between you and God, but I'll do a Bible study with you." So I had Bible study in his house, and people would be coming to buy drugs, you know, like every 10 minutes. And I knew probably 80% of the people that came, you know, from the jail. And the guy would say, "Hey, it's Pastor Robert. He's here. Come on in." So anyway, you have that whole community, which is another layer of immigrant folks. As I was mentioning, the Border Patrol is you know, constantly on the prowl. And in our area, people are stopped, as I said, and it's kind of a common a joke of getting picked up for a DWM, driving while Mexican. And or even a WWM, walking while Mexican. You know, people, pedestrians are commonly just stopped. I mean, I took this picture. I was driving along, taking my kids to swimming lessons, and suddenly I saw the lights flashing, and I just saw this Border Patrol car pull over in front of this guy who was just walking. And two guys got out, one on either side, and they questioned this guy, and they put handcuffs on him and put him in the back of the car and took him off. And so immigrants in our county live in fear that at any time they could just be out of here. So it really, that forces the whole community more underground than ever. Even permanent residents, you know, because they don't want to be hassled, you know, by a Border Patrol. But we've arranged, we've organized what we call the Whatcom Skagit INS Watch Group, which is a group of people. What we do is we've had public meetings with the INS and the Border Patrol, where we bring Border Patrol agents, you know, the INS, that's just distinct from the Border Patrol, local farmers, farm workers, and activists together to air the community's concerns to the INS directly. And that has led to some cooperation where we will get them to help us in certain cases. Certain times the Border Patrol has let people out of jail who they could have taken their papers away because they had, you know, past felonies and things, but because those people were working with our ministry, they released them into our ministry. And in other cases, like this family, the husband was picked up by the Border Patrol, or no, by the police for a warrant because he hadn't paid a traffic ticket. And so he'd gone down to Mexico, and the ticket had been mailed to his address, but he wasn't there. So anyway, he was picked up and in the jail, and his wife doesn't drive. But she says, "Well, you know, I have driven a few times, you know, out in the cucumber fields, down the side, and I think I'll have to drive our family down to Mexico." And so I said, "Oh no, you know, that's kind of dangerous, don't you think? And what if I could arrange for you guys to get a free ride with the Border Patrol, you know, down with your husband, you know, with that woman, the older woman's son? Would you guys accept it?" And they said, "Oh, no, we couldn't do it. They would fingerprint us, and then we'd be in the system. We don't want that." And I said, "What if I could arrange it so that they would promise not to fingerprint me?" And they said, "Well, we'll think about it." So a week later, they came, and they said, "Yes, arrange it, you know, please. You know, we need to get down to Mexico. We want to be reunited with our husband, you know, with the husband once he's deported." So this is they were turning themselves into the Border Patrol. And so sometimes we're able to make it work in people's favor, but most often it's a total interruption. So that's it for the slides, and I think I'll just talk the rest of the time. So, immigrants are in a fragile place, and even people with permanent residents, they're really in a delicate space because there's a new laws, you know, the new the anti-terrorist law. Let's see, what's it called? The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 1996, and another anti-terrorist bill in 1996 have defined. the law, you know, deportable offenses really narrowly. So, I mean, people can get deported. I mean, they can lose their permanent residency papers for crimes that are very minor crimes, you know, relatively minor crimes. I mean, they're all fairly serious. I mean, like driving under the influence of DUI. People can lose their papers and be deported for those sorts of crimes. And they can be, you know, that they can be crimes that were committed 10 years before 1996. So people that have past criminal records, you know, felonies especially, but even small things like a DUI or a domestic violence charge, those people are being, if they end up in jail for anything, even if to do one day or something, that will, you know, the Border Patrol, when they come, they'll do a background check on the person and find that they, 10 years ago, they had a felony drug conviction or something. And even though the person has been clean and sober and off drugs for the last 10 years, they'll take the person up and put them in deportation proceedings. And there are waivers that are available for, you know, to fight those deportations, but most of the immigrant community cannot afford to pay the attorneys what it costs to represent them. You know, it costs a minimum $5,000 to have a, you know, to deal with these cases because they're very complicated, but more like, you know, $10,000. And so immigrants lose their papers, and these are people that have been here 10, 15, 20 years. You know, I know many, many, many people who have been, you know, they got their wife and 5 kids, and they're all U.S. citizens, and they've been, and, you know, they're deported, and they can't come back. And if they come back, which they do, if they're picked up again, they can do up to 3 years in federal prison, you know, if they're caught, you know, for being in the States again. And many of them, and the INS are detaining people now, you know, who are caught after they've been deported and putting them, you know, in federal prisons for 3 years, just for coming back illegally, you know. So, a lot of people who want to become U.S. citizens are kept from approaching, you know, from taking steps towards citizenship because maybe they have a past criminal record. You know, many people do have past criminal records from even when they were, you know, juveniles or, you know, 18, 19 years old. Maybe they're 40 now and they want to become a U.S. citizen, but they're afraid that the INS will find out. Well, they will find out because they do an extensive background check on anyone that wants to become a citizen. So they could lose their permanent residency status if they try to become citizens. So there's just, you know, the immigrant community is suffering, you know, big time. And it's not just Hispanic people, it's Vietnamese, it's, you know, Laotians, it's all kinds of people. It's, you know, the whole immigrant community. There's Russians and just tons of people that are experiencing these problems. Uh-huh.
Could you say just a little bit more about your opposition to the child labor laws? And I assume that you're talking about people who are here legally and who are getting legal employment.
Yes.
But could you say a bit more? Because from my perspective, there seems to be a fairly good rationale for the child labor laws.
Okay. The problem that I see is that parents who are doing farm work are required, in order to make a living, one wage earner cannot bring in an income that's enough to be able to cover the costs of a family. Okay, so pretty much the whole family has to be working. You know, everyone over 13, however many people that is, to pay the rent. You know, and I mean, I know lots of people that they'll live. There'll be 3 or 4 families that will live in one apartment. You know, I could take you guys into Skagit County and show you 20, 30 apartments that have 26 people in them, 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom apartments. You know, and these are people that, you know, they're able to save that way, you know, but everyone is working. And, you know, but if you want to have a more sane existence and say live in one, you know, by yourself in an apartment, you know, for sure people, everyone has to be working. That means that the kids and the hours that people work in the farm work are long, long hours. And that's partly because farmers don't have a real shortage of workers, of laborers. You know, there just aren't enough farm workers to go around. Also, because, you know, when the harvest comes, you got to get it, you know, get it picked. And so farmers, you know, no matter who they are, you have to work long hours at harvest time. So anyway, that means that if these young people, I mean, the young kids that are under 13, who's going to supervise them? Where are they going to be? Who's going to raise them?
If they're here legally, and that would be the only reason that people would be following the child labor laws, if they're here legally, why wouldn't they be in some sort of public school system?
During the summer?
Oh, okay, so during the summer.
Yeah, during the summer. But even during the fall, I mean, there's a problem. There are programs set up for migrant children, you know, and that's a great thing. There's, you know, there's migrant Head Start, there's migrant education programs, you know, for people that move from county to county and state to state, and they can kind of, they pull their kids out of one school and then they can plug in somewhere else, but it's really inadequate. And there also are migrant, you know, kind of daycares and things like that, but once kids get to a certain age, they don't go for that, and they just run with their crowd. And they get raised by other kids. And that's where, and these are kids that are growing up speaking English. Their parents are Spanish speakers. And so there's a huge kind of, I mean, there's a cultural kind of language gap and everything that begins to develop between first generation immigrants and their children.
I was just curious if you know, has Canada presented a different kind of policy model at all? I know you're just across the border. And I don't know how much migrant farm work there is in Canada.
Well, Canada has a totally different system. I mean, you can basically come up to Canada and declare yourself a refugee, and you're allowed in, and they'll put you on welfare just right from day one.
Yeah. Well, what about non-refugees, though? I mean, like.
Well, most people can't get into Canada unless they claim they're refugees. So they'll claim they're refugees even though they're not. And I know many people that aren't refugees that have gone in and done this. And it takes the Canadian government maybe three to five years to investigate to find out whether the claim's valid. And by that time, you know, the woman or the man, they have kids and they're well established, and you know, then they're told you gotta go. You know, so it's a nutty system. I mean, the Canadian system is just crazy. It's just wreaking havoc. You know, I know so many people that have been deported back to Canada and their kids and families are separated, and I don't know what they do with their migrant. There's a lot of us Shiite folks that are, you know, that are migrants in Vancouver, or Sikhs, excuse me.
Oh.
Yeah. What you say about reading between the lines is that I gather there's selective enforcement of laws.
Well, a lot of people would say that. I mean, there's a lot of Canadians working in this country illegally, and here illegally, but because they're white, they're not targeted.
Well, I know anything about long racial lines, but just in general, that there's selective law enforcement of the laws going on.
The facts are is that farmers are completely dependent upon these, you know, these migrant farm workers, and our culture does not produce a labor force that's capable of this kind of work,
yeah,
or that desires to even do it, right? So that's where right now there's a lot of big farming operations that are moving south of the border, and you know, with NAFTA, that's easy to do. And there's a lot of farmers in our county that they're looking at it. I mean, if they have any more INS crackdowns, they're going to go out of business. And you know, the small farmers are the ones that are really hurting the most. You know, because they are totally dependent upon. I mean, smaller farmers need more intensive crops. You know, like strawberries, and you know, that require laborers. One of the big markets is small cucumbers, right? But in order to selectively pick small cucumbers, you can't do it machine pick cucumbers. That doesn't work. You have to have people out there doing it, and that's how they make their money. And if there aren't people, they're out of, you know, they're going to sell out. So one thing we're doing is we're bringing together farmland preservationist groups, environmental groups, you know, farmers, and activists and farm workers together to look at the issue in a broader way, right? If you want to protect farmland, you got to protect farmers. If you want to protect farmers, you got to protect farm workers. You know, otherwise, you know, agriculture, we're going to be buying all of our produce from south of the border.
Do you have any idea how many INF workers there are, how many Border Patrol people there are, and the craziness of this in terms of the salaries that are paid to have people deported and then come right back up and have this go on over and over again, and have people paid to capture them, and then they're gone and then they're up here again. I mean, it's just the craziness of it in terms of resources is amazing to me. It seems like we wouldn't want to do that,
Yeah, oh yeah. There's so much money that's being spent on this. And, you know, Clinton has increased the number of Border Patrol agents. I mean, just way, way up. I wish I had all those figures in my head here, but or on paper, but I don't.
Isn't there some social and economic mobility among these immigrants? So I noticed in California that in terms of the service industries, that these are mainly Hispanic people now who are going to the service industries, you know, into restaurants and into hotels. You go to hotels, and most of the help there are Hispanic people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if these people, some of them didn't come in as farm labor, you know, and then get into these other jobs which are better paying and perhaps are also labor conditions are better controlled too.
Yeah, that's true. There is an upward mobility for the migrant farm workers, and one of the problems that one of the reasons that a lot of farmers want a guest worker program.
They say that if you say there was an amnesty and all the undocumented people were given amnesty, that would help the, you know, the activists say, well, yeah, that's great for the farm workers, you know, but the farmers say that it's not a solution for us because once people are here legally, you know, they're going to want to get out of the fields, right? So that's why
they really need the illegals.
Yeah, and there's a big push, and I'm really active in kind of pushing for a guest worker program that would be a just, you know, that would have guarantees for the farm workers, you know. But right now, under the current Congress, they're so responsive to the big agribusiness people that they're not about to, you know, to pass a guest worker program that would have those guarantees. I mean, that probably all the guarantees would just get stripped out at the very end, out of the bill, and it'd be a terrible guest worker program. So,
do you know what the breakdown is between farm workers who are here legally and farm workers who are here illegally?
That's a hard thing to tell, but I mean, most of the farmers, the big farmers in our area, the small farmers, they're all small farmers, they all say that they figure about 50, a little over 50% of their workforce is undocumented. And I think that it's about the same in Eastern Washington.
But isn't each farmer at least theoretically compelled by law to check the green card of each employee?
Yeah, but there's a law that requires the farmer to, they have to have an I-9, fill out an I-9, which requires them to take, you know, like a social security number and a, you know, and a, maybe a green card or whatever, some kind of ID, maybe a birth certificate. They have to have photocopies of those things, but they're not required to check the to verify whether the papers are authentic. And there's a, you know, for $50 you can get an artificial green card, you know, permanent residency card, and that's what people do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, it's not the job of the grower to check that. It's a basically that's a loophole though that allows farmers or any employer to hire someone.
Yeah.
But now the new law, the new immigration enforcement, the new system that the INS is using is actually much more efficient and much more devastating. What they're doing is they're going and they're auditing farmers and they're asking for all their to see all the I-9s, and then they check, they cross-reference or cross-check the Social Security number with, you know, with the Department of Social Security, and they find out whether it's false, and then they'll check the green card, you know, the residency card, and then they'll give, basically they'll just give the grower the names of all these people, and they'll tell all the growers in the area, here's the names of people you have to fire, you can't hire, and then they'll check up on them. If they've hired them, they get a huge fine. So they're just, all these people are getting unemployed, right? But most of the people that are losing their jobs aren't going back to Mexico. They're just going, they hear through the grapevine where those things, you know, there isn't enforcement happening, and they'll just go there.
Because I know a lot of the immigrants in our area, the Midwest, that they're staying now.
That's how it is in our area too, and that's partly because the border, for undocumented immigrants, it's so hard to get across the border. It's so expensive that they're staying, and you know, for long.
They stay, and then they drive like they can make it from Wilmer to the border, I guess, in a day and a night, and they go there and collect some money, whatever, And then they come back. Mm-hmm. And now they have to, I worked for the Salvation Army this past winter and helped with their Christmas baskets and that. And all these Hispanics that came in, you know, they had to have their driver's license, their social security card for all their kids and the whole bit. But they have to live in the area a month before the welfare will kick in to help.
Yeah, and that's if they're documented. If they're undocumented, there's very little welfare they can get. They can get something for their children who are US, who are born here, but it's pretty minimal.
They used to have a lot of people come into the Salvation Army for food baskets and that, but now it's getting less and less every year because it's hard for them to. Because sometimes, like, their income was greater than mine, and yet they were coming in and wanting food baskets, and of course they have a line. Mm-hmm. And I had to turn some down, and it's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah, there are some families that really flourish, and they do very well, you know, as farm workers, there's no doubt about it. And there are others that, you know, that have drug problems or alcohol problems, and so their money gets spent, you know, that way too. So, but there's a whole, you know, vast sort of diversity out there of people.
Have you seen any impact after the Hurricane Mitch that the United States government has sort of changed the rules, has promoted works in Honduras, or has eased the system for those who are here illegally?
There's a special waiver for people from Central America, from Guatemala, Mexico, and Nicaragua, that they can apply if they've been here. If they're here now, they can apply for to stay longer because of Hurricane Mitch. Yeah, I've heard that, but I don't deal with that many Hondurans, Central Americans in our area. I know that one of the greatest draws for Hondurans in our area is Vancouver, because the whole heroin, cocaine, drugs, scene is all run by Hondurans. And they have a whole system of recruiting, just the poorest of the poor in Honduras to bring up as drug dealers in Vancouver.
It seems like we're in a terrible catch-22. For one thing, the way we participate in all that is by demanding low produce prices.
Yeah.
But if the farmer were to pay a wage that would attract workers, I mean, that's the way the capitalistic system works, then we would probably not want to pay, and then the stuff would still go south to where it could be underproduced. I mean, the prices would be less than imported in this country. So it's like the logic of it is amazing.
Yeah, in a way, the consumers, we're the ones that are creating a lot of the props, just by our we're looking for the cheapest prices and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of need for consumer education. One of the things that we've done is we have a 5-acre field of, this year we have 8 acres, where we have a cooperative farm for farm workers. And we have 25 families that have gathered and are all taking a section of this that we planted. We got farmers to grow, to plant it, and then they're gonna basically do all the weeding and harvest it and market it. And we're gonna be selling all that produce in the churches, and as a way for these farm workers to have a direct connection, producer, consumer kind of connection. And as a way for them to make some extra money and to raise awareness in the churches. But that's just a drop in the bucket, just 25 families. And but that's the kind of thing that I think we need a lot of education among, in our churches and just among consumers about these issues. Because if we're successful at getting rid of all undocumented people out of the United States, we're gonna have, we're gonna see a lot of small farmers and a lot of big farms and other industries go under. And we're going to have, there's going to be big impact on our economy, I think.
You talked about a guest worker bill that would have certain guarantees. What are those guarantees that you would want to see in any kind of guest worker?
Well, I would like to see a wage, a more livable wage, you know, guarantee, and maybe some kind of health care benefit that would be tied into that. Some people say that there should be the grower should put up a bond, you know, for every farm worker, every immigrant they want to bring in, maybe $1,000 per person that would cover health care and a number of other things. And, you know, that would make it possible. I mean, it would be like the farmer would take more responsibility for the workers instead of just everything being left up to the workers and the workers suffering the brunt of all this enforcement. So, yeah, for sure, a wage and also housing guarantee. You know, right now, the codes are such in our country that the building codes are such that there's no room for temporary housing. I mean, you know, everything has to be like permanent housing. And so farmers cannot afford to house people, and they don't need to house people in structures that are, you know, that are as excellent as, you know, what the codes require. You know, so farmers, there's no way that they even can legally improve their housing. You know, so there's a need for changes in some of the housing, you know, the codes in the counties around our country where we have lots of farm workers so that there can be improvements in housing, you know, and I think those things should all go together with some kind of a bill, or at least farmers should be required to provide housing, you know, adequate housing, you know, adequate job, wages, for sure, those sorts of things.
Is there any pro bono attorney in your church that would dedicate some time to these issues?
You know, I'm on the board of Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, I guess. That's the largest group in the Northwest that has pro bono attorneys, and our organization has been so flooded with with people that, I mean, we've had to close down for 3 or 4 months at a time just to catch up with the caseload. You know, there's like 25 staff, right? Anyone that decides they're going to be pro bono just is immediately overwhelmed because there's such a huge need for pro bono attorneys. I have a number of them that work with me. I'm calling them every other day about people, and we do legal clinics up in our area where these attorney friends will come up and you know, they'll meet with one person for 15 minutes and give them advice, and you know, and then maybe schedule a longer appointment where they can pay them, you know.
And union leaders?
Union leaders. Well, the problem with unions is, I mean, that's a whole other issue. There's not the United Farm Workers are trying to organize, and I guess successfully organizing in Eastern Washington. In our area, there's not much union activity. So the people have no protections, you know. But that's what, we live in a small enough county where our objective is to try to work with the growers. And we are, we're working with most all of the farmers in our county that have farm workers. And what we do is we have a chaplaincy ministry where we go out into the camps and with permission from the farmers, and then we hear all the complaints from the farm workers. And then, you know, commonly I will call the farmer and say, well, do you want to hear what I'm hearing? You know, and they'll say, well, I don't really want to hear it, but go ahead and tell me. So, you know, the ideal, I think, is that sort of thing where you can kind of work out solutions on a farm-by-farm basis, you know, because, I don't know, maybe that isn't the ideal, maybe farm organizing is, but I know that in our area, if the United Farm Workers were successful at raising the wages up to where some of them want them, some of our farmers would go under. A lot of our farmers would completely go bankrupt.
How much are those unions asking for over what is customary right now?
You know, I don't know the exact statistics on that, but you know, there's definite need, especially in Eastern Washington, where you have these huge multi, you know, big agribusiness operations, you know, and there are lots of abuses, and these are groups that could pay a lot more than they're paying, although that's rapidly changing because apples are, you know, the international market for apples is really, these apple growers are a real problem because of apples coming out of China, I think, You know, so I don't know. I mean, the globalization of agriculture is, you know, is creating all kinds of problems for farmers in this country.
It seems to me that the way that you've set it, that not that you set it up, but that it's been set up, is that someone's going to have to lose out, because either the small farms are going to go out of business because they're paying some sort of livable wage, or if the farms stay in business, the only way they can do it is by paying substandard wages. So it seems like there's a...
No, farmers can pay a livable wage, even the small farmers. They can successfully do that. You know, I think they can. It's just a matter of who defines what a livable wage is.
Okay.
You know, and United Farm Workers, I think that they're pretty, you know, pretty good. But in some cases, they're out of touch with, you know, with it, with the local economy, with the economics of these growers. And there's a major.
So there is a possibility, you think?
I think there's a possibility.
Some sort of equilibrium.
I think there is.
Are the small farmers competing with the big farmers, or are they in niche markets?
They're in niche markets.
Yeah. Which is good, because then if they do pay a livable wage, they can pass that cost on, hopefully, to the consumer, and the consumer is buying the niche product rather than the major product.
Yeah. But I think the consumer, there needs to be a lot of consumer education so consumers can come alongside farmers, you know, and be willing to pay the prices that it really costs, you know, to grow crops. And I really like the movement of, you know, the organic sort of movement that's happening in this country. I think that's a move in the right direction. You know, we should be paying. The quality of our food has gone down so low because of all the pesticides and all the chemicals that are being used, and that hurts the farmers too. And the farm workers get hurt by that. I've seen so many examples of people that work in Eastern Washington walk over here, and the apples, you know, where their fingernails stop growing, and they have just horrible skin problems, and you know, they get this, what do you call it when you're allergic to chemicals?
Well, I'm sure lung disease, too.
And lung diseases, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so I would like to see agriculture move more into this specialty market, and like to see consumers be willing to pay more for quality produce. And that would affect everybody, it would help everybody.
All these big corporations are taking over, you know, and they can set prices because they can afford to, and they've got their own meat plants, and they've got their own, you know, and I know I'm on the outreach board in the Southwest Minnesota district anyway. Our main concern now is all the little farmers are going out of business, mm-hmm. because the bigger farmers are taking over, and they've figured out there's a bean now that they can plant, and when it gets to a certain stage, it kills the weeds.
Oh, wow.
And so, but then, what's this going to do? Will it be able? Is that going to kill the weeds? And will it be able to plant next year because they've got this stuff in the ground? Will it kill everything? When you hear all these people talk about what's happening, it's really scary. And we as ordinary people don't know all this stuff that's going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we can cut the tape here, but I think we're in a really dangerous situation in our country. You know, agriculture and just the quality of food, and you know, is going down, 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 and you know, but the lives of these farm workers, you know, I mean, these are people that are working long, long hours, and you know, and it's a thankless job. You know, many of them experience a lot what they call, you know, discrimination. I mean, typically, I've done many Bible studies with farm workers, and you know, I've used Exodus chapter 3, and I'll talk about the groanings of the Israelites, and I'll say, well, what are the groanings of the farm worker community? And I've been so surprised that the first groan that everyone always says, no matter who they are, they could be some evangelical church, you know, or I wouldn't expect it at all, I mean, really conservative, fundamentalist sort of folks, and they'd say, Everyone says the same thing. They say discrimination, racism. They say that people look at them, when they're in the supermarket, women will hold their purses closer when they walk by, and you know, they just feel like they're targeted by the police, and it's just they feel like they're really on the margins of the society, and they are. And now with the immigration, the new policies, and with the racial targeting, and the police, the cooperation between police and INS, that's forcing the community more and more underground. And there's no incentive to comply with the laws. You know, so if people can't comply, compliance means, you know, you're going to be in more trouble. I've had people.